You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Hey, Don, what was with that wind that we had? I mean, trees came down, branches everywhere. That was pretty amazing. How strong was that wind to knock down all those branches?
2-day wind event where we had gusts in the 25, 26, 27 mile an hour range going on overnight and into the early hours of Monday. And yes, there was a lot of tree injury. This is the first significant north wind we've had in quite a while, actually. We get these regularly, and when they do come in, they're gusty, and they do snap branches, and they kick up a lot of dust and allergies, and people are generally grumpy about it. More to the point, we then spend, as with arborists in the region and city tree department staff and everybody else connected to anything related to shade trees, a lot of time talking to people about what happened to their tree during the course of that wind event. We had at least two people whose fig trees blew over, for example. I don't know why figs in particular, but I came home and I have a long row of fig trees that I grow for propagation stock. And the one on the north end is now at about a 30 degree angle. So we had large trees split limbs. We had small trees snap at the, well, you know, where they were tied on the stake. Today's weather is 93 degrees. It is May 20th, 2026, as we record the program for broadcast on May 21st, 2026. Quick shout out to the listener who noted a difficulty accessing the show last Thursday. It was delayed by a day. Did get it up there, so it should be there. But then the wind blew the station off the air, which happens periodically. So they're able to rebuild it and everything is where it needs to be and the archives are happening again. But if there was a delay, it was either my fault or the wind. Take your pick. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, will be 96 degrees here in Davis. Low tonight, and also Thursday night, 57 degrees. Friday will be 95 degrees. Friday night, 54. Very light breezes. We're not looking at north wind again, just high temperature as this high pressure ridge has built a bit over the region. And then we should cool off pretty dramatically. Friday night will go down to 54 degrees, and Saturday will only be 86 degrees. 3-day holiday weekend for a lot of folks traveling. Well, it should be very pleasant here in Northern California. Saturday night will be 53 degrees. Sunday, 87 degrees. Sunday night, 53 degrees. Monday, Memorial Day, sunny with a high near 86. Monday night, mostly clear with a low around 53. And Tuesday, sunny with a high near 81. Then a pretty rapid cool off, interestingly. May 26th, looking at Weather Underground, 74 degrees. So we're going to drop back down, get some pretty strong coastal Delta breeze influence, and then back into the low to mid 80s by next weekend. So basically, temperatures are going to be about 55 to 85 degrees for about the next week after we get through this brief little heat surge over the next day or so. This is perfect planting weather for just about everything. So we'll certainly come back to that. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And many, many thanks to those of you who did so during our spring fundraiser. We met our goal, I believe, and you can still donate. You can go to kdrt.org/support and you can donate money. You can donate your car. You can donate your time or all three of those things. Whatever makes you happy to help KDRT stay on the air.
And that our DJ Rocky Outcrop Is wrapping up the spring fundraiser with a special thank you gift. It's going to be a random selection of from people who have donated $75 or more through the kdrt.org/donate method. And so if you did that, or if you want to do that, go right ahead. Then send an email expressing your interest and being considered for getting these tickets. Send it to info@kdrt.org no later than Monday. That's the 25th of May. And one email will be chosen at random, and Rocky will announce the lucky winner on the May 29th show. The Yolo County Breakdown is his show.
KDRT would like to thank the California Bluegrass Association for their generous contribution. More information about the festival at californiabluegrass.org. I got to mention, Rocky has a coup. Rocky Outcrop, who is a programmer here, does Yolo County Breakdown, seems to know a lot of interesting people in the music industry. Well, guess who's going to be coming in to his show in person? Banjoist Bella Fleck, who has 19 Grammy Awards, and opera singer Renee Fleming, who has 5 Grammy Awards as a soprano and is also an actress. They've teamed up in a collaboration called The Fiddle and the Drum. This is an album featuring mountain songs, haunting ballads, and folk hymns. It releases soon, followed by live performances throughout the rest of 2026. Well, you can hear a preview on the Yolo County Breakdown this week, Friday, May 22nd at 10 a.m. right here on KDRT. That's right. KDRT DJ Rocky Outcrop welcomes banjoist Bella Fleck and opera singer Renee Fleming to the Yolo County Breakdown, Friday, May 22nd, 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, KDRT 95.7 FM and KDRT.org worldwide. Yolo County Master Gardeners are continuing their webinars, and on May 28th, they will have Diseases and Disorders in Vegetable Gardens. The presenter is Mackenzie Patton, who is an integrated pest management advisor for UC Cooperative Extension. It will cover a variety of abiotic disorders. That is one of my all-time favorite terms. And, diseases common in the Sacramento Valley. They'll teach you how to tell the difference between environmental stresses and actual diseases and disorders in vegetable gardens. These are webinars. The Zoom link is provided at the site that gives you the information about this event. Did you find a link to this?
All right. So the link is really long and hard to say over the radio. So I made a short one. I don't know if you all know about Bitly. bit.ly is the company that allows you to put in a long URL and get a short one back. And you can even specify what words you want. So here's the short link, bit.ly/MGYOLOEvent.
There you go. MG for Master Gardener, YOLO for Yolo County Event. July 9th, the new Arboretum All-Star Plants. July 23rd, Composting with Worms. And here's one that looks great out in August. So I want to mention it now. You can mark your calendar. August 13th, Kevin Marini, UCANR, Best Practices of Great Gardeners. August 13th. And these are webinars, so you attend via Zoom. We'll give you more information about that one as it gets a little bit closer.
All right. Looking at our emails, I see one from Gaina. Says, hi there. I heard your show today. Thank you for answering my question about fertilizing my 2 outdoor azaleas. I bought the fertilizer from your store at some point, and I'll provide a picture and a picture of the instructions on the bag. I have learned that organic fertilizer is better to use than synthetic. I made a note to water the soil first and then apply the fertilizer from now on. So, should I follow the instructions on the bag or fertilize less frequently as you suggested? And this is an azalea, camellia, and gardenia food. It's an organic food, and the instruction says, for container plants, apply 1 tablespoon for every 6 inches of pot diameter, feed monthly spring through summer. And we said...
I don't remember what we said. For a
don't
container,
remember what we said? You said
for a container once a month is not unreasonable because nutrients don't tend to stay in the container real well. But my recollection is that my comment was feed seasonally. So spring, summer, fall would probably be fine. Plant performance, of course, can tell you to some degree whether you're giving it enough plant food. Is it growing the expected amount that year? Is the color medium to dark green and so forth? So that would be one guide if you actually have a basis for comparison of what the foliage should look like versus what it does look like. That wouldn't necessarily be intuitive to everybody. I have found that almost every fertilizer product I've sold over the years says feed monthly. That's not unreasonable. There are plants that would benefit from that regular fertilizer. And the problem is, I can just imagine being on the technical committee that's trying to figure out what verbiage to put on fertilizer products. All right, we're going to sell this to people who are growing azaleas in the ground or in containers. In containers with a rich soil with lots of organic stuff, or faster draining, more mineral type soil. In the ground, where are they? Is it the high density soil, or is a whole bunch of organic stuff been added? All of those things affect the cation exchange capacity of the soil, the ability to retain nutrients. So if you say feed monthly, yeah, that's probably a reasonable compromise. Without knowing exactly what your soil type is and exactly, you know, where you are, you won't hurt it by feeding monthly. It may be a little more often than it needs, but it won't hurt if you follow that rate. It tells you one tablespoon, you know, whatever it was. It's in front of us here, right? Here we are. Yes, for one tablespoon for every 6 inches of pot diameter. This is a pretty low nitrogen content, and it's an organic base, so you aren't likely to burn. So once a month following that would probably be fine. Again, they're trying to guess what's the best advice to give to everybody everywhere. Here, you're watering a lot, so it's not going to retain nutrients real well. You've got it in partial shade. If you used a soil that's got a fair bit of organic stuff, it would probably hold those nutrients for as much as 2 to 3 months. So you wouldn't absolutely need to feed monthly. But if you happen to buy a cactus and succulent mix, which is predominantly mineral, or our citrus mix, for example, which is predominantly mineral, monthly might be necessary. So I'm going to tell you seasonally, but don't hesitate to go to monthly if you don't feel like you're getting the growth and color that you need.
It's not going to hurt the plant. And if your plants are sitting outside in a container and there's a little stuff that washes down, well, it'll just wash over to the nearest bed. And
yeah, the plant nearby will make use of it. Yes, make sure the plants nearby would benefit. One thing, the comment about preferring organic versus conventional, it depends on the results you're after. When someone comes in whose vegetables aren't growing real well, I'll be happy to sell them fish emulsion, or we have an EB Stone product that's an organic fertilizer derived from corn syrup, corn liquor. Sure, those are 3 or 4% nitrogen. But if they're really not getting going and you've got something at home like one of the conventional fertilizer products that have been on the market forever, they will work faster. So if you need some growth now because you think your plants are stalling, you might choose to use a conventional fertilizer. If you know they're looking okay and the color is good and you're getting the expected result, you just want to give them a boost, then organic would be longer term, but slower to take effect. So that's the main difference there. But my biggest concern is plants with very fine roots. And we learned this the hard way at times. Azaleas, blueberries, things like that. You take a conventional fertilizer that contains nitrate in particular, which is added to most conventional fertilizers because it's very fast acting, or contains ammonia, ammonium sulfate, which is also relatively fast acting. Those are going to dramatically affect the root zone. And on most woody plants, it's fine. You know, they've got bark protecting the root to some degree. They've got heavier roots that just aren't as fragile. But some plants, you'll fry them if you use conventional fertilizers, particularly blueberries. I strongly recommend you not use conventional fertilizers for blueberries. And I would say, closely related, very similar type of root structure, azaleas would be in the same category. I just wouldn't feed them with a conventional fertilizer in a container, especially going into hot weather, especially if it's a little drought stress. Too many especialties in there, too many variables for that. So that's why an organic fertilizer is safer. Way back when we opened, we had old guys, remember we opened in 1981, who would be coming in looking for sulfate of ammonia or urea. Sulfate of ammonia was 21:0:0. Those were the macronutrient ratio. 21% nitrogen, straight ammonium, 0 phosphorus, 0 potassium. Extremely inexpensive. I remember a 20-pound bag was $3.99. A 20-pound bag of lawn food was $8.99. So you could get nitrogen for half the price. And these old guys wanted to do that. Even better, urea formaldehyde. Think about using that as a fertilizer. Derived from the petroleum industry, 39% nitrogen, 0 phosphorus. And I, to this day, remember getting an argument, pleasant, but an argument with an old pomology professor. Why don't you stock urea? I said, because most of my customers would fry their plants with it. Yeah, but it's the cheapest source of nitrogen. I said, yeah, you know what you're doing. Okay.
Order it online.
Well, ma'am, there was no... there was no online. We didn't have cell phones in those days. Then he was looking for the urea. And I said, I mean, I could bring in a bag for you, but do you really think I should sell that to the average person? You know what you're doing. Now, when you flatter someone that way, the argument dissipates. But in any event, he was looking for the cheapest source of nitrogen. And there was no question in those days. The nitrogen fertilizers that were synthetic were way cheaper than any organic fertilizers. There was about a 3 to 4 fold difference in price between conventional and organic. That has changed. Organics have become cheaper. Conventional have become more expensive. On a unit of nitrogen basis, synthetic fertilizers are still cheaper. But for what you're buying and the results you get, it's comparable in terms of cost to use organic fertilizers, and you can use them less often and get just as good results. We've learned something about nitrogen. A lot of what was being applied in the past was wasted. It was going either through the container and going away, or it was going into the ground and the next irrigation took it out of the root zone. We know that because groundwater was getting contaminated, because there was runoff in storm drains. If it's there, then it isn't where the plant needs it, obviously. So we know that the way it was being applied was inefficient. Part of that has to do with how soluble synthetic fertilizers are, particularly ammonia, which literally will volatilize into gaseous ammonia, or things like urea, which is very soluble and not held on too well by soil particles. So I don't want to get into upper division soil science here, but a lot of that cheaper synthetic fertilizer that you were applying wasn't going to the plant you were applying it to. Organic fertilizers get it where it needs to be and do it more gently. So there's been a huge shift in the nursery industry in the years I've been in business. We had a little tiny display of organic fertilizers, niche market, just the hippie types coming in looking for their organic fertilizers, and everybody else wanted their 3900 urea. Nowadays, if I've got a conventional fertilizer, it's on the ground, it's over in the corner, it's that one old guy that still wants that. Everybody else has gone to organics. And part of it is they don't inadvertently fry their plants. Too many people that used to use the conventionals just wouldn't apply them correctly. Admittedly, they were probably not reading the label direction. So this gets us back to an extremely important truism, whether you're talking about a pesticide or a fertilizer. Read and follow the label directions. Seems like we shouldn't
have. And if they're too small for you to read, go online and they'll be there big enough for you to see.
Yes. What age is it where we get the magnifying glass so we can read the fertilizer label? Anyway, Gaina, I hope that helps. I gave you a little more information, I think, than you were after there, but you get the idea.
All right. Tara from Oakland writes, ooh, good morning. I'm seeking some help with my pest ID. My white light sunflowers that matured in April never opened properly. The petals kind of failed and the main flower was misshapen. I left one growing and it has formed side buds that are even more grotesque. Yeah. Really, every time I'm out there, I see a ladybug on the sunflowers. Please let me know if a pest is causing this deformity. If so, is there anything I can do to break up the cycle so my succession plantings of sunflowers aren't impacted? And so she has sent some pictures.
Yeah, great picture. This looks like botrytis gray mold, which is one of the things that spoils fruit, causes fleshy petals of flowers to get moldy and rot. We see it here when we have long periods of dank, damp weather, mostly fog rather than rain. And sure what it looks like here. And unfortunately, it looks like it just totally destroyed the inflorescence as it was developing, which is very sad. The good news is for your succession planting of sunflowers, even in Oakland, you'll get out of this at some point. You'll get up in the temperature range where the plants will be happier. I know you have morning fog every day, but at least it burns off middle of the day. And you should get your next crop just fine. But this is pretty bad. It's very frustrating. The spores are there. They're always there. They're always on things. If you ever take a basket of strawberries and leave it on your counter until they're spoiled, you'll get this gray mold. This is the same thing, botrytis gray mold that grows on the fruit. And when it grows on a plant, usually, our experience is a big problem in the nursery industry. Usually, it'll attack as a blossom that is done or a fleshy petal that is fading and is ready to decline, and you'll get this mold. This is part of the process of decomposing it, but it can progress into healthy tissue. We have a big problem with it on cyclamen, for example, and primroses in the nursery industry. Get a little bit up on the fleshy flower petal, and the next thing you know, the next day is foggy. The next day is foggy. It's gone from that older petal into the new healthy petal. Then it's in the flower itself. Then it's progressed down the flower stem into the main plant, and the whole plant will rot. So botrytis can progress into healthy tissue and cause the plants to get really gross, like these sunflowers, unfortunately. What stops it is the same thing as always stops fungus, which is drier weather, warmer weather. You know, so once you get past the day after day of overcast weather that you presumably were having as these flower buds were initiating, you should be fine. But it doesn't look like these plants are going to be any good. Looks like your next generation of sunflowers is going to be more satisfactory.
So if I understand what you just said, Don, take out this sunflower.
As well, yeah.
Get rid of it.
Yep.
And don't worry about the next sunflower you plant in the area because it's not a disease that carries over from plant to plant.
It could.
It spores in the air.
It's always there. I mean, it could carry from plant to plant. So in taking that plant out, I would certainly just not leave it lying there, but it's already present. This is the thing. Botrytis is one of those organisms. It's already out there, just waiting for the right conditions to attack.
Enclosed is a photo of my new trilateral peach next to a spicy Z nectar plum. Is this peach leaf curl? I think you've said to leave it alone instead of picking off the impacted leaves. Do I leave it alone?
It's not going to spread at this point to any further infection. Yes, that's classic peach leaf curl.
Can you describe it for our listeners?
It's lumpy, blistery stuff on the leaves, and it's usually pink to red, so it stands out. This is why peach leaf curl is so horrifying to people. It's like the most ghastly looking disease you can get in the garden. It looks like a gall. A bunch of galls have grown on the leaf. Now, it's a fungus. It attacks as the leaf buds split and the leaves begin to emerge is the main period of infection. And so it is splashing. It requires a particular temperature range and requires splashing droplets of water, not just fog or drizzle, but actual rain for 4 to 6 hours is necessary to spread peach leaf curl. So some years we get it really badly because we have rain just timed at the period of leaf bud break. Some years, my experience with peach leaf curl this year on all of my peaches and nectarines was barely there at all because it was very dry during that period. Having said that, a few weeks ago, I made that comment and a listener mentioned it to his friend who also listens sometimes and knows me and promptly sent me a picture of his red barren peach that had a lot of leaf curl. So my experience was not universal, but I definitely had less leaf curl on my trees really than ever this year.
That's in the Davis area.
In my outside of Dixon where I am, yeah, and he had more on his tree in Davis. I don't know what the difference is, but in general, I have noticed that the extent of leaf curl, number of leaves affected, percentage of leaves affected, directly correlates with rainfall at the time of bud break. If you're dry and windy, then you're going to have a little bit of leaf curl. If it's rainy and splattery, then you're going to have a lot of leaf curl. Some varieties are more resistant. Some are more susceptible. I don't worry too much about that because, as I've said many times, in our area, a healthy peach tree on a good rootstock will outgrow peach leaf curl in a matter of 4 to 6 weeks. And this has only got 3 or 4 leaves affected, so it's even less of an issue. We sometimes get a secondary infection. That might even be what we're looking at here. The primary infection is most of the leaves pushing out. If you happen to get that combination of splashing rain and the right temperature, most of the leaves will be infected. Anywhere from 30% to as much as 80 or 90% of the leaves will show these blisters on them or whatever you want to call them. It's still photosynthesizing, so the plant isn't being hurt that much. What does hurt is that a high level of infection, a lot of those leaves will drop. Obviously, tree dropping its leaves as it's trying to grow, it's going to weaken it somewhat. If it's on a level rootstock or another good, sturdy rootstock, it'll just outgrow that with no problem. This is part of why I don't like Citation rootstock. It dwarfs the plant, makes it less able, in my opinion, and observation, to outgrow peach leaf curl. But that secondary infection can occur when you have the first leaves infected, and then we have another rainstorm right at the right temperature range and right moisture range, and we get smaller areas of infection on subsequent growth. I've even seen years where it rains a lot where we have tertiary, you know, third levels of infection, but each subsequent infection is significantly less than the main one. It's that primary infection we're most concerned about. Thanks. Nothing really to be done except to watch the tree outgrow it. As I can see from this picture, it's already doing.
And just so that the listeners will have in their head how things look, please describe that leaf curl that's with the black aphids.
Which happens primarily on plums and apricots. So first of all, if your leaves are curling on a plum or an apricot, it's not peach leaf curl. Peach leaf curl only attacks peaches nectarines and the interspecific hybrids with them. So the nectar plum, which happens to be a nectarine crossed with a plum, regrettably, the leaf curl susceptibility of the nectarine was conferred to that particular interspecific hybrid, and my nectar plum gets really bad peach leaf curl. But in general, if a regular plum or an apricot and the leaves are, has leaves that are curled or buckled, just turn them over, open them out, and you'll find the aphid that's causing it. It's a very specific aphid that goes primarily to plums and apricots. A little hard to control because you'll see it's sort of curling the leaf around it as the population grows. So let's pretend you had a pesticide that was going to be effective for that. You go out there and spray. Well, the average person who's spraying is standing there showering pesticide down onto the tree, like as if it were rain, and these aphids are on the underside of the leaf, so they're sheltered from it. So if you're going to spray with anything, you need to spray upward, which means you're going to splatter it towards yourself. I don't really recommend that. So if you're going to spray with water, that's great. And it works pretty well on this one. It's a harder one to get controlled because of its that the fact that the leaves sort of curl around it. But if you have this aphid, particular aphid on your plums, pluots, or apricots, get a jet nozzle and go out there and just pressure wash the tree. And people are so concerned about this. Knock all the leaves off. No, it won't. Knock all the fruit off. Some of them should be knocked off. That'd be fine. Don't worry about it. You probably should have done some fruit thinning this year anyway. And you can get pretty good control, especially if you do that. This is really the key. 2 to 3 days in a row. Even, you know, the first day, really thorough. Just get every aphid you can see, every leaf you can see. And then just go out the next day and do it again, even if you're not seeing them. And we typically, when we have any kind of a pest problem in this group, aphids, whiteflies, any of that category at our nursery, we'll do 3 days in a row on the infested plants. And then we monitor from that point. Generally speaking, 2 to 3 days in a row will knock the population down sufficiently. Getting added moisture in the area draws beneficials in. Problem solves itself. But if you do get that particular aphid on your plum and apricot, it'll sort of look like peach leaf curl, but it's really easy diagnostic. Just turn it over and look on the underside of the leaf, and there they will be. Many of them already parasitized. There are plenty of beneficial insects that will parasitize that particular aphid. It just seems to take a little bit longer to get going. So it's very common to get 12 to 18 inches of new growth on your plum, curled by this black aphid. And then once we hit upper 80s to low 90s and the new growth is continuing, you'll notice it comes out unaffected. There's a specific temperature range for reproduction for every species of aphid. And this one, once we hit about 90 degrees, population levels off, beneficials start to give control, problem goes away.
Hey, it's going to be 90 degrees tomorrow.
Yeah, that's actually the Perfect. Weather we've had, the north wind we had, unpleasant as it was. And the higher temperatures that we're having, much as people are whining about them, making a huge difference in reducing the disease and pest problems that we're building up, particularly the fungus problems, the leaf spot stuff we all talked about the last couple of weeks. That's just going to stop. And all the affected leaves blew away. So problem solved.
Well, Don sometimes sends me pictures. And today he sent one as, well, a challenge. Do you know what this is, Lilith? I haven't got a clue. I don't think I've ever seen this tree before. It's just, they're just like naked flowers. They're very strange.
Yes, and they're pretty much just little pollen factories. What I sent you is a picture of a tree that's not common in our area, but other listeners in further north and higher elevation climates might be familiar with linden trees.
Linden.
Tilia cordata is the one I have. Little leaf linden, Tilia cordata, the most common cultivar is green spire, and that's what this is. I planted this tree about 40 years ago. It's about 40 feet tall. So they're not real fast growing, but it has progressed very steadily. This is in the subcategory. Perhaps this could be an ongoing feature. Trees I love, but don't recommend for one reason or another. In fact, I found an old question in a folder from several years ago, and I wrote it down as, I heard you say there are trees that you have, but you don't recommend, comma, why, question mark. And reading it, I kept thinking, did the person mean why do you have them if you don't recommend them? Or if you have them, why don't you recommend them? Either way. So we can do this as sort of an ongoing feature periodically. Tilia cordata, little leaf linden. And here and there around Davis, you'll see Tilia eucora, the Crimean linden. Linden trees are much more associated with northern latitudes, Scandinavia, Europe. These are European species and rainier parts of the United States. It's a beautiful tree. It is very uniform in growth habit. The green spire starts out very columnar and then gradually becomes broader and becomes a giant gumdrop. And this tree, as I say, 40 feet tall, 20 to 30 feet across in full bloom. And they smell just exactly like sweet alyssum. It has that sweet honey scent. And we're talking thousands and thousands of flowers all at once. It does this every spring. And I'm always amazed by how many different beneficial insects visit the flowers. So Lois notes these flowers appear to be mostly just pollen creating portions. They're not really a big showy flower. There's enough of them on there that it's impressive. And when you walk under the tree, that sweet honey scent, like a sweet alyssum, is almost overpowering. But the last couple of evenings, I've gone out just at dusk to look up into this tree. And then over the next hour or so, checking on it, hundreds of moths going up and down to the flowers of a particular moth. I'm going to try and catch one and figure out what it is. Clearly very attracted to this tree. Lace wings. I would venture thousands. It's really hard to say how many there are, but you're standing there looking up and they're just basically float, these gossamer winged, green, beautiful insect floating up and down on the air currents within the tree, stopping to, there's aphids on there, stopping to oviposit and feed a little bit on the stuff that the aphids are producing. And then during the daytime, all kinds of beneficial flies. I know that sounds strange, but also beneficial wasps that go after aphids and whatnot. This tree is a factory of beneficial insects right now, and all kinds of things coming to it during the daytime, during the night. So if you have a place where you can plant a tree and you don't mind some aphids on the tree, that's why I wouldn't really recommend it. You will be doing all of your neighbors a favor by creating habitat, nesting sites, reproductive sites, if you will, for thousands and thousands of beneficial insects of at least two or three species that I know and a bunch that I didn't recognize. Little leaf linden, it does need a lot of water. It grows anywhere that maples do well, for example. And I have this in an area which was a lawn originally. When I took out the lawn, I continued carefully irrigating this tree with its own irrigation as if it were still in turf, because I know that this actually would prefer that. I've taken it through periods of drought. In the 40 years it's been in the ground, there have been times when we've all been cutting back on irrigation and the soil has been very dry. And when that happens, if it gets drought stressed, the leaves scorch, much as maple leaves will in some cases. It doesn't really hurt the tree, but it sure looks bad and it stays looking bad for the rest of the summer. So I've learned that this is one of the trees. As we're going into a heat wave, it gets its own deep soaking. But if you're in a climate where this does well, linden trees are spectacular and really actually great for the ecosystem if that happens to be a place where they do well.
The flowers, each individual flower is really small. It's like the size of your thumbnail, maybe, or fingernail. And then the inflorescence itself, you could hold in your hand. They're not big, but there's a whole lot of them.
And they're it's about a 4 week bloom, and during that period, as I say, the insect activity is phenomenal. Now, even once it's out of bloom, I'll go out in the summer when we're having fairly balmy conditions, even I see the lace wings sort of floating up and down in there by the dozens and possibly even hundreds. So the reason they're there is the reason I don't really recommend Tilia cordata, which is that you're going to get aphids. I guarantee it. They will get aphids almost wherever you are. If you start seeing the super highways of ants going up into the tree, you'll get aphids really badly because the ants will go up there and they'll tend and protect the aphids. Not sure what they do to the lace wings, but the ants can really be a factor in terms of the aphid population. If you have a practical way to control ants going up into your tree, there are a variety of things you could spray on the trunk, for example, to kill the ants. That can minimize the aphid problem to some degree, but it will be there. Every summer, at some point under this tree, it's kind of sticky. I have a backyard where that doesn't matter. I don't have furniture or anything under it during that period. I wash off the ground and whatnot. It's not disgusting, but it is sticky. You wouldn't want your kids' play structures or anything like that out there. So trees that routinely get aphids, we don't really recommend. But that and the lack of drought tolerance are the reasons that I wouldn't specifically put this on a recommended tree list for the valley. Here in Davis, in town, there are a couple streets where Tilia cordata is the street tree. I Street, some also on Columbia Place, which is here at East, over at East Davis. They're beautiful trees, but for whatever reason, most of them got topped at some point after they were planted. I don't know whether it was intentionally, that does happen, unfortunately, or during a windstorm or something. So they're much more round than is natural. All of the lindens or street trees that I've seen look unnatural to me because they have been inadvertently or intentionally turned into rounder headed trees. But they're lovely. If you happen to have one, if it's your street tree on I Street or Columbia or one of the other streets, it'll be really nice for that tree if you give it some extra water as we go into extremely hot temperatures or long periods without rainfall, because it is not fundamentally a xeric or a low water tree. They're tolerant, but they look best if they're given deep soakings. I only water mine deeply every 10 to 14 days. You know, this is not constant. There are things around it getting watered, so that's certainly a factor in how well it does. And I always make sure there's mulch under this tree of some sort. So that's really important, is to shade the roots and have organic mulch helping to protect them and conserve the moisture. But if you're up in the northern areas, lindens are lovely trees. Oregon, Washington, places like that. The other reason you might be cautious about planting them in public areas, they're very, very attractive to bees. I mean, there's a specific label proscription on certain imidacloprid products because, rather famously, up in Oregon, there was a parking lot in a shopping center where they had tilia trees, linden trees, in full bloom. And of course, they had aphids. And so the landscape management company treated the trees with a systemic imidacloprid. Our guess is they probably exceeded the label dosage, but it doesn't really matter because that was not a label appropriate treatment in that situation anyway. And the next day, thousands of dead bumblebees were all over the ground in the parking lot. It was a big story at the time. It got a lot of publicity. They got in a lot of trouble, as indeed they should have. And there was subsequently a label specific proscription on the use of systemics on linden trees because of that incident, because they're so attractive to honeybees. If you don't want a tree that gets aphids and attracts pollinators in a public space where it might get treated with the wrong kind of pesticide. The bees themselves, very mellow when they're going to a big tree that's in bloom, but some people in public areas simply don't like to be in the presence of bees. So be aware of that one if you're planning a park or a green belt or something like that. It's a lovely tree, just be aware you're likely to get aphids. So that's exercise one in the trees Don loves but doesn't recommend ongoing category.
Well, Don sent me a link to an article that is on his website. It's called Hot Weather in the Garden. This is from August of 2020 when we had a heat wave, and it was over 100 for many days. And so this is talking about the physiological effects to the plants and what you should do. And Don, it's going to be 96 for one day, and then we're coming back down. Do we have to worry about this whole heat wave thing?
No, we need to plan now for the heat waves we're sure to get at some point this summer, since there's never been a summer here where we haven't had at least a couple days over 100. We've had anywhere from 7 to 10 to as many as 25 or 30. The more typical pattern is 10 to 12 days over 100. But what really concerns me is the 3 to 5 day heat events. So I wanted to mention this now. We're only going to be 90 something for a day or two. Okay, well, that will stress some things. We'll talk about that in a moment. But as we get further into June and into July, it's a high likelihood that one of those great big high pressure domes will build over the Four Corners region of the US and expand outward over the American Southwest and expand into the southern part of the Central Valley. And every so often, not every time, but every so often, it's big enough to literally expand over where we are here in Northern California. And I even recall times when very large, high-pressure domes have expanded out over San Francisco Bay Area. I've been in San Francisco once when it was 100 degrees. Mm-hmm. That happened again just a few years ago. It's not pleasant there. It's 100 degrees. They're not used to it. Drives them all crazy all along the coast when that happens. Fortunately, it doesn't happen very often. It even happens less in Davis than in Sacramento, for example, because we're just closer to the coast. We tend to benefit from coastal influence more than perhaps other parts of the interior. But when we get a 3 to 5 day heat event, it's really good going into that. If we mentioned on the garden show, for example, look, this next week, we've got a major heat wave coming. Really soak everything down before that. That's what I really prefer to do myself. When we mention that on the show, I tend to finish up recording, edit the show, and then go out and start turning on drip lines on different parts of my property to give them, in many cases on my property, anywhere from 6 to 24 hours soaking, depending on the drip line, what's on it, and so forth, because I want to have all the soil nicely hydrated going into the hot weather. I prefer not to irrigate during an extreme heat event because it increases the risk of crown and root rot, but it's better to irrigate if the plants are stressed than not. So, you know, try to do it beforehand if you possibly can. And now is the time to look at how you're going to water the bigger trees. In other words, did you have a ring of drip around a bigger tree that you're going to run for several hours? Do you have sprinklers in there that are covering and distributing water accurately? Look now, because I can guarantee in 4 or 5 weeks, we'll probably be mentioning one of these 3 to 5 day heat events coming up. The other is it got really hot by comparison with previous weeks. It was very windy. The ET rate for the last week was 2.4 inches.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. We usually talk about one in the summer.
Oh, two. No, 2 inches is typical. 1.8 to 1.9, as much as two inches is typical in the summer. In the summer. We're not in the summer. We're technically still in spring. And so that was a hot July week last week, basically. That kind of wind. Wind is the biggest factor in evapotranspiration. And so it was relatively warm, 90-ish. It was very low humidity, 10, 15% at times, and of course, dry and windy. So the ET rate was comparable to July or August in May. I hope you all adjusted for that. Judging by some of the pictures that were sent to us, I would say no. Young seedlings in particular, you had things that were planted 3 days before that you skipped a watering on, or you didn't water deeply enough, and they look really stressed. And the question
replanting then, is coming up, isn't it?
Maybe this is the thing. Should I put in a new one? Well, I could just go buy a new one. But I will say, try soaking it really thoroughly. And by that, I mean, however long you've been doing it, quadruple it. Temporarily. Okay. Really hydrate the zone. I was being flippant there, but not very, because the conversations we're having are, of course, the drip system running 5 to 10 minutes. I'm going to say, well, try
maybe 30, 5, 10 hours.
Well, no, but let's try 30 to 40 minutes. If it's in a raised planter and you've got a drip system, that'll give you a couple days hydration, depending on what your soil is and how your output is and other
factors. And how fast it drains.
Right,
yeah.
How fast it drains and how fast the water goes in and how much it can hold are the three major factors. You probably cannot overwater, even though we hate that term, we're going to use it. You probably cannot overwater a plant during a dry wind event. Southern California Santa Ana winds, Northern California north winds like this. With the humidity that low and the ET rate that high, going out and turning on your system and letting it run for a couple of hours would not hurt. And doing it again the next day might even be necessary. That's during the period itself of extreme temperature and particularly extreme wind with the low humidity. Learning what is a drought stress symptom, for example, withering on the margins of the leaf. That's really a simple one. When the leaf starts to wilt, the furthest part from the root goes first. So it's going to be the edges of the leaves, the tip of the leaf. It'll die in from the edge and the tip. Sometimes you'll get scorching on the leaf simply because the waxy coating on some things like peppers or even tomatoes has thinned out. So it sunburns. So you get scalding on the leaf. So withering and scalding are bad signs, but the plant can overcome those. Those are just going to be cosmetic. As long as the new growth can continue, the plant is probably okay. The problem is if it got dry enough to kill the growing point. So in the case of a tomato, it'll just form new growing points. You've been set back 2 to 3 weeks, but it'll just flush out from below the point they got injured. If it's in the cucurbitaceae, which is squash, melons, cucumbers, pumpkins, if it loses the growing point, it's going to kind of have to start over. So that's a case where I would just put in another plant. I never pull out a plant. It stays there. It's fine. Just leave it there. Don't worry about it. Go buy a new one or plant some more seed, whatever is easier for you, right next to the existing plant, because you are going to be set back by as much as 2 weeks or more if the growing point, if the growing shoot of a cucurbitaceae is killed or broken. Probably should go ahead and start over, or at least just plant another. Also, one of the pictures that got sent to me was a really good illustration. I don't know if you looked at them. These seedlings in this raised planter, it's bare soil around them. It's absolute bare dirt. So what you need to do whenever you plant new plants and we have a sudden change in the weather, especially going towards the dry and the hot end of things, is mulch. And the first thing that goes when a plant is stressed other than the leaves and the new growth is the blossom or the developing fruit. So drought stress significantly affects your yield.
So Don, it is May. The show is on May 21st.
Mm-hmm.
What should you be planting or could you be planting at this time of year?
Everything? No, not everything, but a lot of things. It's a very, very active planting time. It's pretty funny when we hit 90 degrees. I always, the staff is always like, who's going to be the first one that walks in and says, I guess it's getting kind of late. I guess I missed the planting season on my vegetables. And no,
this is Davis. You can plant through August.
Well,
depends on what you're planting.
Well, but I mean, we spend so much time telling people it's too early to plant that it's kind of funny when as soon as it's perfect for planting, we start hearing, I guess it's kind of late. So May is a very active planting time for vegetables and flowers. It is a great time to plant tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, tomatillos. Excellent time to plant summer squash. Melons can finally go in. It's finally warm enough for melons. Cucumbers, great time to plant them. I do, by the way, recommend successive plantings of cucumbers. I think we talked about that a few weeks ago. You can still plant beans, although be aware that green beans are a little heat sensitive in terms of yield, but you can still plant them. Radishes, beets, and carrots. And those always kind of surprise people. The root vegetables are generally thought of as cool season vegetables. It's certainly easier to grow them during the rainfall season here because consistent irrigation with root vegetables is crucial, or they simply won't develop properly. So you want to have them in a bed where the watering is even throughout the bed. Micro sprayers work better than drippers for most of the root vegetables, but they can be planted at any time. Radishes grown in the hot weather are pepperier. They have more mustard oil in them, so they're stronger flavored, but they grow just fine. Beets and carrots, likewise, have slightly different flavor profile. They're more tender in the cool season, but they can be grown. You can also plant Swiss chard and green onions, and you can plant strawberries and a bunch of other things. There's a whole lot of other things that can go in, most especially basil. It is perfect basil planting weather now. If you like regular sweet basil, plant every 3-4 weeks because it'll go to flower pretty quickly. Just let it flower, let the bees enjoy it. Just keep planting new plants out. It's easy from seed if you want to do it that way. If you happen to plant the Emerald Tower series, one plant of that will last all season because it doesn't bloom for like 12 weeks. Mine actually never bloomed the first year, 12 to 16 weeks before it blooms. So basil goes in now with the warmer soil conditions. And if you have room, it's a great time to plant corn. Every few weeks, another block of corn, winter squash, and pumpkins. But again, those last two, all three of them, corn, winter squash, and pumpkins, take a lot of space. As do melons. You got to have a lot of room for those. So that's more of an out in the country kind of thing, but worth growing at least once, even in a relatively small garden.
What about flowers? I want flowers, Don.
Well, most of the ones I can think of off the top of my head are sun lovers, but we'll go through some of those zinnias, which I really think more people should be growing. There's some amazing zinnias out there. They love the heat. They do extremely well here all the way practically till frost. Marigolds, very popular. Cosmos, great for drawing beneficials. Celosia, amaranthus, these are all things that can go in now. They really want warm soil. So those are ones we would wait until mid-May, and we can plant all the way into July in the case of the ones I just mentioned. There's also a lot of summer flowering things that will be blooming mid to late summer. Good idea to get blooms in and around your vegetable garden all through the season.
It's perennials you're talking about now, right?
Yeah, perennials. So things like California fuchsia, the epilobium, formerly classed as zauchneria. You can find those in nurseries now. They'll start blooming midsummer, bloom right through the fall. Hummingbirds love them. Coreopsis pretty much blooms all the time, actually. These new Coreopsis varieties are in constant bloom. Dahlias go in now. They need warm soil. We mentioned Gaillardia as something that loves to go in.
Gaillardia. Oh, that's bloom. A beautiful picture.
Yeah, blanket flower. And it's something that typically blooms in the summer, but also blooms in the winter. So as far as I can tell, it's a year-round bloom, at least on mine. Gloriosa daisy. Now, again,
that's Rudbeckia, isn't it?
Yes, black-eyed Susan. I'm a little critical of the bedding plant industry for the things they've done to some popular old perennials as they focused on dwarfer growth habit, tighter growth habit, branching from the base. Rudbeckia is one of those plants that the modern hybrids, in my opinion, are not as good as the older varieties. So look for old-fashioned Rudbeckias. In fact, look for Rudbeckia Goldsturm. Rudbeckia Goldsturm, which is a variety of Rudbeckia fulgida is the way it's spelled, F-U-L-G-I-D-A. My plant that I put in 6 years ago is now about 4 feet across, heavy bloom from late July through August into September, classic old-fashioned black-eyed Susan flowers on a plant about 3 to 4 feet tall, comes back year after year. These modern hybrids seem to be 2 to 3 year plants, predominantly Rudbeckia parentage, which is a biennial. So you'll get more bloom for your buck out of Rudbeckia fulgida or fulgida Goldsturm. Highly recommend that one. If you like daisies, Scabiosa blooms year round, but easy to plant anytime. Status, I mean, really blooms year round. And Shasta daisies, which are mid to late summer bloom. So those are all things you can put in anytime now for bloom later in the summer, even into the fall and the winter. Yeah, there's some things you don't plant now.
Well, lettuces you grow in the winter.
I'm unaware of any lettuce varieties that I can say to home gardeners, yeah, plant this one right on through the summer. Also affects the flavor and the texture. So it's really not the right season. Lettuce is wonderful when it's cold and there's even moisture. It's crisp texture. It is sweeter in the summer. It's just not as desirable, even if we were able to grow it. And that goes for spinach and kale, cabbage, broccoli. Those are just not planted in hot weather. So just leave a place for them. You'll start planting some of those as early as August, September, October. You'll be going in a big way. And bear in mind that your summer vegetables are still going strong at that time of year. So leave a space for some of those things to go in early. And there are some of those leafy greens you can start planting, let's say as early as late September, but really nothing before then. It is also not when we plant onions and garlic. We plant those here in the fall. And then we'll be harvesting in late spring, early summer. And it's not the right time to plant cilantro. I get that question quite regularly. Since people want to associate it with their peppers and their tomatoes, it is that kind of a salsa ingredient. Unfortunately, in the valley, it's a cool season plant and doesn't like freezing weather. So it's great September, October, November. And it's good late January, February, March. Once we get into April, we hit 85, 90 degrees. It just goes to flower. Let it go to flower. Lots of beneficial insects like it. Let it go to seed. If you use coriander in cooking, that's what it is. But cilantro itself, the leafy green portion of it, is a cool season thing. They can grow it in the coastal parts of California year round. Here, we really only grow it in the cusp seasons, the late winter and the early to mid fall.
Okay, I have another email here, and this is from Robin in Davis. It's about her diseased blackberries, and she sent pictures. Do you know what's happening to these berries? It happened overnight as they got ripe. I haven't seen any culprits yet. Any suggestions? And Don looked at these and went, oh, no.
Bad news here. I would take those rather yucky looking berries. Now, it's possible this is a disease. They get botrytis. They do get the same gray mold that rots the fruit that you can get on strawberries and other things. But unfortunately, blackberries, like strawberries and raspberries, can also host spotted wing Drosophila.
That's that cherry worm wiggler thing.
Cherry worm wiggler thing, yeah. They are attracted to red fruit primarily. So they're more attracted to red cherries, for example, than nearby blackberries. They're more attracted to red raspberries than nearby blackberries, but they will go to blackberries.
So and blackberries are red at certain times of their life.
Yeah, and normally this is an insect that oviposits as the color is intensifying and it's getting close to ripe. Unlike a lot of fruit flies, which only attack spoiling fruit, this one gets into the fruit before it ripens, before it's completely soft. So in the red stage of a boysenberry, for example, which is more red than purple, I could imagine you could get spotted wing Drosophila just as it's changing to its last color stage. And I have had people tell me they sometimes get problems with spotted wing Drosophila on blackberries. Really easy diagnostic. Pick a whole bunch of them. I know they're gross. Snip them off with something. Put them in a bowl. Fill the bowl with water. The worms will float to the surface. It'll be very obvious. If it's botrytis or one of the rot type organisms, it'll just happen to this batch. It's possible that some that were pushing along the later stage of ripening development over the last few days will come out just fine because of the dry wind that we had. So it's entirely possible that you'll still have some good fruit on there. But I would check for that spotted wing Drosophila. If it's really bad on a blackberry planting that you have, look nearby for a cherry tree. Because what typically has been happening since this pest has been with us since 2011, I think it is now, a lot of people just took out their cherries. That's what I did. When I finally hit my trees, it was gross. I just took out the cherry trees. But a lot of people just stopped harvesting. And that would be okay, except that that can build up quite a disease, or excuse me, quite a pest population on an individual tree or group of trees. The fruit's falling to the ground, they're going through the various generations, and it just gets worse and worse. And if there's only one food source and the population is increasing, they will indeed seek out other soft fruits nearby. The host range for this pest in Japan, where it comes from, is every soft fruit you can think of, basically. Peaches, plums, nectarines, you name it. But it has an upper temperature range of about 82 degrees, above which they've stopped reproducing. So in our area, the biggest problem is just the things that ripen in May. which in our area happens to be cherries. It makes them very lucrative to grow here. In fact, commercially, they're a very valuable crop in the Stockton region, which is one of the first places this pest showed up because of the early harvest. So they're turning color while the temperature is still within the reproductive temperature range of spotted wing Drosophila. By the time we get into June, they're past that. So your peaches and your nectarines and plums and apricots and such, we simply don't get problems on those here. I'm told they are a bit of a problem in other areas. But the early ripening pattern of blackberries, boysenberries, raspberries, and sometimes strawberries can lead to a sort of a secondary infestation. And if you've got a bunch of blackberries, now you have a population of them in there. I'm not completely sure about this, so I'd like you to take a bunch of these, put them in a bowl, fill it with water, and see if the worms come floating out. If not, then you know you actually had a rot instead of an insect, which would be good, because treating for it is almost impossible. The simple answer when you have a big infestation with this, find the nearby source. If it's a cherry tree that someone has abandoned, it'd be great if that could be taken out. If it won't be taken out, all the fruit needs to be picked up off the ground and disposed of. That's unlikely to happen, but it's certainly worth considering. Then consider severe pruning on your berries. Take them to the ground and take everything out and just get rid of it completely. In areas where the cherries are the primary crop, it is recommended that raspberries and blackberries be removed entirely, because they are sort of a host or a pest repository nearby. In your case, you don't have to remove them entirely, and that's nearly impossible to do with blackberries anyway, I can tell you from considerable experience. So your best bet is just a full-on pruning, take everything away, get it out of there, go through with a blower, get all the fruit off the ground, try and clean it out that way. Sprays for this pest have been not real effective, although some are using spinosad. But again, that's something you'd want to be using. You'd be using it right as the fruit ripens, which is the biggest issue we have with this pest, is you have to spray as the fruit is getting close to harvest. And that's not, obviously, a lot of home gardeners aren't really interested in doing that. So you need to be aware that this will probably continue year to year if it is the particular insect pest. Better clean everything out, but look for a nearby source for the spotted wing Drosophila. If it's the rot, we can just blame it on the weather. Next year should be fine.
And our garden quote today comes from Lee May. And he says, I've never seen a gardener who hasn't got room for one more plant.
The aimless look of someone with a 1 gallon perennial in their hand wandering up and down the driveway border going, nope, can't plant there. There's bulb there. Nope, can't plant there. Got something already in there. Guess I got one plant too many. Maybe I'll plant them on the other side of the driveway. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRTLP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Hey, we've got a K-Dirt alert. DJ Rocky Outcrop wraps up K-Dirt's spring fundraiser with a special thank you gift for one lucky donor, a pair of full festival passes to the Father's Day Bluegrass Festival in Grass Valley. For a chance at those tickets, just make a donation of $75 or more via kdrt.org/donate. Then send an email expressing your interest to info@kdirt.org no later than Monday, May 25th. One email will be chosen at random, and Rocky will announce the lucky donor on May 29th on the Yolo County Breakdown. The Father's Day Bluegrass Festival, sponsored by the California Bluegrass Association, has been held at the Nevada County Fairgrounds in Grass Valley since 1976. This year's lineup includes the Bluegrass Cardinals, the Sam Grisman Project, the Poe Ramblin' Boys, Broken Compass Bluegrass, and many, many more. KDRT thanks the California Bluegrass Association for their generous contribution. More festival information at californiabluegrass.org.